We're going to go ahead and get started. We're still waiting for a couple of people. There might be a little confusion over the change in venue this evening, but we've got some business that we can take care of while we wait. So let's start with roll call and introductions for the Tuesday, September 6th, Clark County Historic Preservation Commission. We'll begin on my left.
Sean Denison.
Robert Cummins.
Sarah Fox.
Brock Bailey.
Rocky.
And we have some guests with us this evening, so please.
I'm Sally Fisher with the Public Health Service.
And I'm Lee Radford. I'm with the PIO Department at Clark County.
And.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm thinking that's. I'm Sharon Lombetto with Clark County Community Planning.
Jim Baker, City of Vancouver.
John White, the City of Vancouver.
Jackie Camp from Clark County.
Welcome. All right, so let's begin with the approval of the minutes from the June 7th and August 2nd meetings. We'll begin with June 7th. I believe we have... how many people were present for the June 7th meeting?
Just wrong.
Just three, yeah. And August, we have...
Three.
Oh.
Okay.
I guess we can't deal with the minutes then. Let's go ahead and...
Staying
out of there,
right?
Yeah,
Minutes are approved. All right, let's jump in and begin with our public hearing this evening. This is for the Certificate of Appropriateness application for the Clark County Poor Farm proposal for new educational signage for the compost demonstration site. First, I'll begin by asking the commission members to announce any ex parte and contacts or conflicts of interest with respect to this review. If there are none, then we'll move forward and open the public hearing.
This is case HST number 2016-00001 for certificate of appropriateness for proposed educational signage for the compost demonstration site at the 78th Street Heritage Farm of the historic name Clark County Poor Farm. The historic Clark County Poor Farm, also known as the 78th Street Heritage Farm, is located at 1919 Northeast 78th Street. The property owners, Clark County, have applied for a certificate of appropriateness for new interpretive educational signage for the composting demonstration site at the farm. The farm is listed in the Clark County Heritage Register. As the agricultural landscape conveys the historic significance of the property's association with welfare support and agricultural development through its use as the Clark County Poor Farm and the Southwest Washington Experiment Station, elements added to the landscape will be reviewed by the Historic Preservation Commission to ensure there is no significant impact to the historic site. The application states that there will be 12 signs in total. The series include one composting demonstration site sign identifying the site, one outdoor main interpretive sign, introduction to composting cycle, and 10 shovel face signs. The signs are designed for self-guided tours that provide information about composting techniques. There will also be workshops at the farm presented by the Clark County Master Composter Recycling Program for people that want a classroom and hands-on experience. The proposed signage will be located south of the administration building and just north of the orchard as shown on the demonstration site and campus location photo of the application. The compost station and its signage is part of the implementation of the site's master plan that was developed in 2010. As stated in the master plan, in addition to the historic features and community gathering venues, the 78th Street WSC property will provide, this site also offers an exciting opportunity to educate visitors about sustainable design and environmental stewardship. So to review this application, the Historic Preservation Commission utilizes the Secretary of the Interior Standards for Rehabilitation. So I reviewed those that felt applicable to this proposal. So that started with number one, every reasonable effort shall be made to provide compatible use for a property which requires minimal alteration of the building structure or site and its environment or to use the property for its originally intended purposes. As stated in the master plan, the site has been envisioned as an important neighborhood gathering space, place that builds community pride. Year-round community members of all ages will take advantage of the site's many agricultural and educational amenities. Nomination states, the agricultural landscape and associated buildings and sites convey the historic significance of the property's association with welfare support and agricultural development throughout its use as the Clark County Poor Farm and Southwestern Washington Experiment Station. Reviewing the proposed signage proposal submitted, staff does not find that the signage series for the compost station significantly impacts the historic landscape. The demonstration site and signage seems to be compatible use for the property. Number two, the distinguishing original qualities or character of a building structure or site and its environment shall not be destroyed. The removal or alteration of any historic material or distinctive architectural features should be avoided when possible. Signage. The educational interpretive signs will not remove or alter any historic material, and it doesn't appear that they will destroy the significant setting and feelings of the historic landscape. Number three, all buildings, structures, and sites shall be recognized as products of their own time. Alterations that have no historical basis and which seek to create an earlier appearance shall be discouraged. Finally, staff does not believe that the installation of the proposed educational signs significantly alters the number 4, number 5, and number 6, number 7, I didn't find applicable to this proposal. Number 8, every reasonable effort shall be made to protect and preserve archaeological resources affected by or adjacent to any project. To staff's knowledge, the proposed signs should not affect any archaeological resources. Number 9, contemporary design for alterations and additions to existing properties shall not be discouraged when such alterations and additions do not destroy significant historical, architectural, or cultural material, and such design is compatible with the size, scale, color, materials, and character of the property, neighborhood, or environment. Staff does not find that the proposed compost educational signs destroy any historical, architectural, or cultural materials in the property. And number 10, I didn't find them. So staff's conclusion and recommendations include that the proposal does meet the applicable criteria as stated above and recommends approval.
Thank you, Jackie. Do we have any questions by the commission for the staff regarding this report?
Does the content, it's hard to see on the signs, making me feel old. Did the content of any of the signs have any connection to the historic use?
No, not this demonstration site. No.
You mentioned, Jackie, you mentioned in your step report that it does fall in alignment with the master plan, and I peeped at the master plan, and yes. Is that a consideration within or outside of our
purview? It is outside. I wanted to kind of encompass it all because it's also part of the, when they did the master plan, they incorporated not only the historic nature of the site and that importance as well as what the future lied for that property. So I just, as you all review these types of proposals, I just want to keep everyone up to date on that connection between the nomination and the historic site and historic significance, as well as what the community wanted to see as moving forward from that site.
So it would be context and not criteria.
Yeah.
Questions for the staff?
So there's no chance of, when they're digging the holes for the signs or anything like that, of them encountering any archaeological finds?
There has been a lot of archaeological determinations done there. It's been for agriculture for a long time now. So I'm not aware that it would, but
I mean, it seems like just having language in there as far as inadvertent discoveries, and, you know, I mean, a lot of projects now basically have a blanket statement about inadvertent discoveries. It seems like that could make it into the staff report.
Okay.
We'll kind of cover that.
That's good. Maybe you can make that as part of
Yeah, I mean, if it's, I mean, I didn't take a look if it was in a recorded site. I don't think it is.
I don't think so.
Yeah. So.
If there's no more questions for the staff by the commission, I'll open it up to a presentation by the applicants, if we have one this evening.
Yes, we have. Student staff members from Clark County, Sally Fisher and Lee Radford, so they're here to provide information about the proposal.
Well, we're just really, really excited about putting these signs and this demonstration site on a heritage farm. I don't know if you're familiar with the Master Compost Recycle Program. It started in 1992. I've been working with it since 1998. So we train roughly 3 volunteers every year. They go through a 10-week training to learn all about composting and waste reduction, and then their mission is to go out and educate the public. So these demo sites are really valuable to the program. We have one already in place at Casey Center, which is on 149th Street informal workshop that gives them the opportunity to just interact with the master composters and ask questions. They'll also be able to come to this site and just take kind of a self-guided tour, and our intent is to have a brochure on hand that they can take home with them. Because you can't remember everything you read on a sign when you get home. And if you're like me, you don't remember to take a picture of it. So we're still going to provide the printed material for now. I just think that it's a great thing for the Heritage Farm. It's part of their mission to provide education and farming education. And it's also part of this program solution, so it's a win-win.
In looking at the design of both the interpretive sign and the site demonstration sign has been considered as part of the existing signage and directional signage, wayfinding signage on the property of the composting demonstration site sign, the main interpretive sign that Jackie has had posted. We really took a look at color of both the landscape out there of the existing poor farm building and structure, and really kind of took all of that into consideration on how we were designing the materials so that we had high readability. The main interpretive sign also includes a little feature of a planter box that will be placed in front of it. Visitors come up to the sign coming from behind. So, Jackie, if you could maybe scroll up.
Different page or?
No, just if you just scroll so that we see the schematic at the bottom of it. So there would be a little steel planter box that would be constructed of the same material as the post that the sign rests on, that would have three compartments, if you will, with planted material and then compost actually in the middle. So it's kind of a working demonstration of the end product of the demonstration cycle. So we kept type and the text on the sign really kind of to a minimum to explain the composting process, photography. Many of the images that you see on the sign were photographed out at the farm, so we wanted that authenticity of having people realize that, you know, some of the photos that were on the sign were actually right where they were standing or in the near vicinity. The individual shovel face signs will be posted directly behind each of the composting stations. As Sally mentioned, is a working demonstration site, so those signs will be positioned directly behind or a little bit to the left of each station so that visitors will get information about the different composting systems that are available for either a purchaser or building, and kind of how those systems work.
Was there any consideration of any signage that would talk about how composting would have been done historically on the site, which is much different, if there's even knowledge of that, I guess?
We didn't talk about that, and I don't have knowledge of that. It would be very interesting to learn that. If nothing else, put it in a brochure.
I don't think it's necessary for the appropriateness of these signs, but I think that would be a great addition to the site.
What about a person?
research historical agricultural processes, and mostly they take the straw and manure from farm animals and put it in a big pile and they wait, and then later they put it on fields. Yeah, it's variations on the theme.
Questions of the applicant before we open this up to public comment? If not, I'll invite comments from the public at this time.
Well, I had a question of the student here.
Yes.
When you said that the material comes from the oil you can roll the logs there, but you can roll up those garden plots,
no, they don't want to take their compost. Yeah, but there is a separate composting facility for those people to use. There's, it's right over by the community gardens. There's not, so there's an existing compost.
There is a situation there.
Yes.
Okay, so this is just a demonstration.
This is just a demonstration.
Can you tell me specifically where it's going to be located on the property?
It wasn't.
Yeah, I understand. Okay.
thank you very much, because I have a different comment. But do we have any Jackson and the Aspergillus cases in our county?
You're familiar with Aspergillus?
I am. Yes.
Okay. For the benefit of everyone, is everyone familiar with Aspergillus? Aspergillus is caused by composting. When you raise the issue, and we do have quite a few elderly, that would be a concern. What I am most interested in, as you know, is one, access issues, and you know, the educational process, and making certain that we are on a continuum. When I came and commented, you know, on the lighting, I was very much concerned about the structural integrity, and once again, making certain that people understand the history of that farm. It's very disappointing to say, oh, I live near. You know, I often refer to it as the 99-acre farm. But now say the 78th Street farm, and then, oh, the Heritage farm. Nope. And so I get a little concerned with that, you know, we get all of these projects going on, and I realize how hard it is to fight for educational dollars, but we need to be certain that we are maintaining that integrity of that history. So I especially appreciated your comments about the composting in the past. When I look at those signs, and would you mind going back to the 36 by 78 inch sign? Now, first off, I do love the initial composting, the big sign that you have, because it's easy to read, it's simply put. You know, if I had anything to add to it, I would always like to have who's responsible, who to contact, because that can become a difficult, especially when you have people working together, coordinating on projects. But when I look at this one, it looks very much like somebody took a brochure and put it on a sign. And my concern about that is, and I heard a little bit of, you know, maybe in regard of, nobody is going to learn how to compost right then and there from a sign. But we can encourage people to be very interested. So, you know, at the top on the second panel, you know, where I can read from here, composting transforms organic scraps into nutrient-rich soil. That's a great message. It's a convincing message, and it's educational, and it gets people motivated to the next step. I have no idea what is below that, and I think I would be hard-pressed even if I walked all the way up there, and certainly, I'm guessing that's bigger than 78 inches up there. But if I, yeah, okay, so if we enlarge it, but if it's not, and it's still kind of difficult to read, and it might not quite do the job that it should do. And I would just like for you to take extra consideration. You know, Sally, I know you know a little bit about my background, and you know, the first thing that I would do from a, you know, I would apply marketing to, but marketing is, you know, the business side of education, you know, to the government side, is we need to reduce as many things as what we can out of there and try to really, I would like to see it boiled down so that it doesn't become overwhelming. There's just way too much going on in there. I'm all for it. I think your design is really good. I don't think that we have many options when we go back and we look at the age of that farm, how long. It would be really wonderful to have some notation of what those farmers really did. But then my last comment, you know, other than accessibility, being certain that you know, people can get to that. We were chatting about, you know, some of the trails. If you can't trek over tall grass and stumps of grass and some of those things, that is getting to be an issue at that location. But that's not very far from the parking lot to get to that. So probably we could. Maybe not in a wheelchair, but we could. But the next thing is just, I didn't look really closely and I didn't study and I don't have a background in plants or any of those things. But I would think that we should have, again, we looked at it when you folks approved the landscape, and I know they backed up and you guys made sure that we have plants there that actually go. We should really make sure that the photos in there are truly Clark County, that those are the, we can't know maybe a couple hundred years ago what we had, but we should really look hard to make certain that, you know, we have the appropriate I can't even tell what is layered over there on the right. It feels, it looks like asparagus with maybe some beets thrown over, chopped up. But again, I think it needs to be identifiable from some distance, and assuming that we have an elderly population, I'm going to be able to read it differently. I already don't have six pairs of eyes. I want to be able to see it if I can get there. But other than that, I just always applaud the work that you're doing and appreciate it.
And thanks for your input. Those are all great ideas.
Very much. If there's no more public comment, I'll consider the public hearing to be closed, and I'll open this up for the commission to deliberate, and I'll entertain a motion when I'm ready.
I guess I propose a motion to add for number 8, criteria 8, language regarding an inadvertent discovery plan should archaeological materials be encountered during ground disturbing activities.
Inadvertent
discovery plan, an IDP, be implemented, or the project be carried out under an inadvertent discovery plan.
I second the motion.
And if you want some standard language for an IDP, I can shoot it to you.
John, that reminded me, there's probably something in our code that touches that. So
yeah.
I'll help that in and maybe ratify and make sure.
Okay.
Do we need a vote on the IDP suggestion?
I think it could be. Could you make it just as a
part of the motion?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it, do you want to do some more deliberation and then what?
Yeah, I want to make sure we've got all the input that.
Okay.
Yeah, second. Yeah, it'll just all be part of the same motion.
Well, we had a second, so
we have to deliberate.
Yes,
shall we? Yes. Okay, all in favor of the IDP suggestion?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? All right, it's unanimously approved. Any further comments or deliberation regarding this?
Well, I like the suggestion of having more historical. This is a very modern approach to something that's been going on for a very long time. I think it would be nice you talk about manure for horses, cows, chickens, or rabbits, but traditionally, manure is used in fish. So, I think it would be nice to have something that loops back through time, because it did go where this project is. So, I'd like to see something.
And just may I know that, I believe in the master plan, there was an idea to do like a heritage type farm, like a heritage garden on the site eventually. And maybe that would be a good tie-in to kind of keep that historic garden and composting techniques or whatever that was used historically, kind of in an area that depicts that era of agriculture, where this is more of the more modern type of, so that's my goal. I hope that we get to that other piece too, that we can interpret that site, know what was grown, over time, from the donation land claim, farmers through the poor farm, and like do that well here at the site as well.
Is any other comments or suggestions?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
approved.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good work, Jackie. Good report. All right. Moving on. Heritage Overland Review recommendation for 614 Main Street. Approval for facade changes to the Lucky Loan.
Request both revisions to both the east and north face of the existing building, site plan and historic overlay district number 2. Any changes in marquees, awnings, signs, canopies, or other building advantages or permits required or not, we're going to have to take a look at it. We also like to have to take a look at the color palette that we're using. The overriding policy of the Heritage District is to ensure the preservation of both street frontages representative of downtown Vancouver in an earlier time. To encourage the restoration of the facades of older buildings to their original character, to enhance, expand, and economic, cultural, and architectural attraction of the area, and to coordinate the actions of individual property owners to the benefit of all property owners. And in order to do this, the policy and regulations set forth in the chapter is necessary. So what I've done is I've gone through and taken a list of the things that we need to go through. Rather than go through all of them, it appears to me that this particular property meets the requirements that we're looking at, or they don't apply. Jeanette's here, she can give a presentation on it. Do you have any questions of me first? I don't want to go too quickly if I do want.
I didn't get a chance to look at the building again after all these years. I'm just wondering what the condition of the brick is for the building.
You know, it didn't look that bad, but if you look at it pretty close up, there's a couple of places like on the last picture. You can sort of see where it's, this would be the upper, that dental. Yeah, well, you can't see what happened very well. There's a couple of little separations that are on it, but it seems to be in pretty good shape. And again, they're not talking about doing anything. Anything that would affect the structure either way. It's basically like just painted.
So current.
It's already painted though, right?
Right, it's painted, it's white.
So the,
except below the windows is blue.
Yeah.
So the dark areas are already painted?
The dark areas are already painted twice. We should have had a before picture, that's my fault. The building itself, right, there isn't one. The building is basically white with the areas below the windows.
Upper corner. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The first photo, the upper corner, is at the curb.
It's generally, it's a very faded light blue. Yeah, in the upper part. And then they've got dark blue on the top, very topmost cornice, and then they have a thick dark blue band that carries across the entire length of the building, including the north side, over windows and doors. And so that's about shoulder high. And then they've got plywood over their windows that face east above the blue awning in that upper right corner there. you supply wood. It also says guns, gold, jewelry, just different categories of that sort. They're going to take the plywood off and just have the name, have their name, Lucky, and then Pawn Shop, Lucky Bone Pawn Shop, painted in just the name. We're not doing category signage, and have it painted directly on the brick versus on the piece of plywood. So the fasteners that are holding the plywood are coming off, and they're going to. The transom windows up above are painted. They weren't planning on scraping those open either, but at least you'll be able to see the window trim and see the transoms where before they were covered with a heavy awning. But they were going to take all the fasteners for that awning out of the building too and repair the whole, just kind of open the face up again.
So in your rendering, what we're seeing, it looks different on my screen than it does up there. I see mullions.
Yeah, and it's a. There were two. One was an early generation. The one on this page that has the little thumbnail up here was a very early generation that had piqued the interest of the Lucky Loan to continue exploring greater detail of paint schemes, and that was shared initially. Like to head this direction, and then we went a step further and said the more we looked at the building, the amount of architectural detail in there is really pretty significant, and we thought, how can we add use four colors, and what can we do to highlight different aspects of that up above, because that those were kind of like the broad strokes,
just blocked out,
just kind of blocked
so
out. Yeah, that
page
was a really
six
crude.
Is more current. Two pages along, Jack.
The ones that are the full page that show the dental molding and the harvest ridge, those are current.
That's current.
Yeah. And I brought the drawdowns too to show you the real colors because the copies and the pictures up there just wreak havoc with the color. So this was the main body color. And then the trick is to come up with enough contrast, but this is the dark color. You'll see next to it, this is the cream with that. And then this, did you know that each of the pawn shops in downtown, this is something I learned, that when you take something in and you wanted to get money for the pen and they gave you a loan for that, they would give you a plane ticket that's a certain color. And each pawn shop has their own color plane ticket. So in case you wander into the other pawn shop next door and say, I want my, you know, my pen back, and they look at your ticket, and you're, if you're standing in Lucky Loan and you're giving them a pink ticket, they're like, we don't have it. That is not our ticket. You need to go down to such and such pawn shop because they have pink tickets. So blue is Lucky Loan's pawn shop ticket color. So it was important to them that they still have some aspect of blue. That's why their building was painted blue in the first place, in case you didn't buy this up. So they want a little bit of blue on their building. So that's why we've got blue as an accent. So we put that in the band, in the mid-level cornice, and then up above, too.
So this image, other than the painted lettering, is pretty much the deal.
I wanted to ask your opinion. We were trying to decide if we should do between image one and then image. Oh, I guess we only have printed one here. Painting just the dark color in the transom and then the bulkhead directly underneath the window, leaving the columns in between the windows brown, or to end up darkening all of the columns, kind of that whole storefront window system in between as the dark brown. And they were undecided, and I said, well, I'll share. You have both images, and I said, I will ask your opinion if you have a relevant direction. So traditionally, it would be better just to leave the dark above and beneath and have the columns be more pronounced to the body color.
Why is there none of the cream on the lower level?
It has to, there are, the paintability is very narrow, and it had to do with cost for the painters having to do extra little
maybe some cream on the lower level to tie a visual indicator.
I must have misunderstood you. I thought you were saying you would consider darkening the frames, brick painting those frames, or were you just talking about the brick column?
The brick column, yeah, because those were one of the window frames. Yeah.
So the existing paint that's there, is it coming away? Is it exposing brick, or is it still
it's
solid?
Stuck on, yeah. And on the north side, they grit graffiti a lot, so they've got lots of paint on it. I will, on the south side of the building, that faces the empty parking lot, or not the empty parking lot, the parking lot that's between the building and the Schofield building, there's a thin, it's just one row of brick, the entire face, and that brick belongs to the Schofields, not to Lucky Luck. So that brick, at this point, is still going to be that white that faces the parking lot. If the Schofields allow Lucky Loan to have a sign on there, then Lucky Loan would like to paint that wall. But if they're not allowed to have a sign on that wall, then they don't want to paint that wall that's not there. I'd love to have it the same color as the building, because as you enter downtown from the highway and you're coming up Main Street, and the first thing you see is the Schofield building, and then you see this, you start to reveal, and you see this right here. I hate to see the building just have paint, just the front be really nice, and then it's all white. But
currently, all three sides are the same color.
No.
Pretty
different. Yeah. But the blue stuff faded through, and they don't have their dark blue band painted through the parking lot either. So this.
So the color changes on the outside corner.
Yeah, the color changes only on these two.
So there's two blues here, but there's one blue there.
Yeah. They just did all blue. Just like two.
Yeah. So there's the proposals for two blues.
No, it's just this blue. It's in different areas.
The image is curious in terms of dark.
It really jumps out at you. Like the middle band versus the upper level, and then the dental molding trim was going to be that, but it looks bluish in the printout. I was just going to do the green there, and then the trim. There's a rub. There's runs of vertically oriented side by side bricks, so two up around the windows. It looks kind of bluish in here, but I was also going to just have the dark. The brick really has an interesting story on that building that's not apparent from a photograph, but when you're standing there, it's really got a lot of detail to it.
So what I was concerned about is the type of paint that's being used. Information from going to workshops about how a paint can be destroyed from a building. So I was wondering if there's been any discussion about the type of paint, make sure it's still, I guess, breathable, aspects of if this paint that's been on there for whatever years must have been the right paint if it hasn't deteriorated the building yet. So putting a new paint, whatever the type is.
Because I have not had that. The only conversation about paint is whose brand of paint for the color and then the sheen, but I haven't had a conversation with them about, I'm not seeing blistering and sagging. Obviously I've been on the inside, so I don't know about that crystallization,
efflorescence.
Efflorescence, thank you.
I think that's probably a key issue, is how the brick has stood up to being painted, because paint is terrible for brick. Even the vapor permeable stuff that's supposed to be good for brick is terrible for brick. But sometimes you get lucky, and it doesn't do anything to the brick. So I think knowing what the condition of the brick, especially inside that second floor, where the brick has not been allowed to behave the way the brick is meant to behave, is actually pretty important as to whether you want to add more paint to it. It's definitely an improvement.
I like the colors and everything. I'm just concerned that whatever the type of paint.
So what would you
could you do at this point then if it's got paint on it? And it is there something in the preparation of the paint now for receiving this? Is there something that would get put on before, after it gets cleaned, but before this goes down?
I am not the expert. Like it's, I know just enough to know that, that there are experts that I've gone to workshops with, and they will talk for hours about basically all the things not to put onto the paint, how not to do to the paint, what kind of the wrong paint. And so, back before this meeting, I was actually trying to find that contact, so I was like, at least I should have the name of whatever.
I don't know that their painter is that expert either, because they probably called 12 different people and maybe two called back and gave them a bid finally. That was really tough. Can't even believe it. Michelle,
you're talking about like VOC?
No,
it's the interior.
Well, no, you just don't want paint that is, you know, when they say the waterproof or whatever.
Yeah,
I guess that's the worst thing is to seal the building. And whatever paint this is obviously didn't seal that building.
Yeah, and this is not
been able to breathe, and it's been.
And we can make sure it's not the elastomeric style of paint that a lot of times that they talk about, saying, hey, this helps seal the building, and if anything, it just, like, seals in the moisture.
Kills the
paint.
Right.
Kills
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just, you know, like I said, I don't have, I wanted to bring information, but I'm not the expert.
Yeah.
So.
And I know I'm not specifying elastomeric. It's a more expensive product. I know that if it was more expensive, they probably wouldn't be doing it, but I can talk to them.
Well, they should have an idea of how many years the manufacturer expects it to last during a different weather situation. They should have 20-year or whatever paint.
Just as, like standard paint, not the elastomeric paint.
Just ask them how many years is this paint expected to last.
That's what I was talking about. No, I'm talking about the type of the chemical components in the paint. Yeah.
So it's not to seal in and do harm. So the paint manufacturer probably would be a great resource to sometimes they offer warranties. Different projects that I've worked on, sometimes they'll offer warranties if they're out there and they're inspecting the application process, and they're going to be expected to be responsible for the condition of the substrate or the subsurface. So I can start the
I can
information gather, maybe.
I've been to several of these workshops, and I could give an aid. It's funny because getting old, but it's the same guy that shows up and he does his entire 2-hour workshop showing us what bad things people can do to brick buildings. And so,
Would somebody adapt?
Somebody adapt maybe too, but there's that brick guy that shows up.
Well, they might know the brick guy.
Oh, he might. But he shows up with this, and I'm always fascinated by it, but I don't remember the name of the paint.
I know who you're talking about, and I can't remember his name.
He fixes the buildings, but he has such a cool, like, he'll sit there and look at things and tell you exactly what happened and, you know, what to stop doing.
You know what you'd be great to have this contact information for is also that Schofield building on 6th and Main, the one that faces Catacombs and the Hudson, because some of it's really exposed and others still has the stucco over it. And it's just,
I've been to enough days that I know enough to know something's wrong, but I'm not going to be able to diagnose it
for you.
Yeah. So.
And I don't like to be the first to paint brick, but
what's the prep to I mean, do they sandblast it, pressure wash it,
Probably pressure wash it. Didn't ask them that. They just said the painters were going to start as soon as, depending on how this goes, that they were going to have the painters out there as soon as they could start cleaning little moss pockets off the building and scraping anything loose.
What's the date on the building? It's what?
Oh, the year?
19. Well, the age of the building will help with the age of the brick, and the age of the brick will let you know about the kind of brick that it is. And so if we're talking about pre-war brick, then even pressure washing can damage the brick because it may not. not be 19th century brick, but it's still a softer brick. It's not the hard kiln to brick, like, right there. And so even pressure washing. I think that, you know, the two key things are looking at the inside. If the outside looks like, you know, the paint hasn't caused any damage to the brick so far, that's a great encouraging sign. But I think looking at the inside to see if there's efflorescence, see if there's spalling where the brick is actually crumbling and breaking apart, whether there's been loss of the mortar on the inside, and looking anywhere to see if that is happening, because if that's happening, then painting the brick again is going to make it worse. If it's not happening, and it's been painted already, as long as they do the surface prep the right way and they paint it again, then, you know, paint is paint. But I think...
pick the right paint, though.
Yeah, picking the right paint.
So you don't make it a problem.
Regardless of what paint is on there already, at least making sure that that top coat is the right paint and isn't making the situation worse. But I think verifying that the brick is actually in okay shape right now,
yeah,
is probably the most important thing. And then more details about the process, the surface prep, and the product going on are really important. Honestly, the colors, you know, paint is paint, colors change. Once it's painted, I don't think that that's as big of an issue. I think the condition of the underlying material and what's going to happen to the underlying material long term is the real issue. It is a big improvement, though, I have to say. And as far as your, you know, the input, keep the piers the body color, because the piers were the body color when they were brick. And so, you know, so I that would be just my totally non-preservation feedback on that. But I think more information about the state of the brick and the process is really important.
Surface prep, the process, to the type of paint, so that you're not accelerating or introducing decay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go worst case scenario. There's efflorescence and a soft brick, and it's painted now.
Efflorescence isn't the worst case scenario. Spalling and loss of entire bricks is the worst case scenario, because that can happen on the inside and you won't see a single thing on the outside. A brick wall is meant to get wet and to dry. It's meant to dry both to the interior and to the exterior.
Okay.
So when you put the paint on the inside, on the outside, it's maybe not a terrible thing, because most of the drying happens to the interior unless you've insulated. But you need the moisture to be able to get out, and when you're forcing it to go out through just a few limited places, it has dissolved salts from the environment that go out, and that's the efflorescence. It's actually salt. But it also, when those salts form, they actually break the brick apart from the inside. And they break the mortar apart, which is actually what's supposed to happen. But you can lose entire bricks and tons of mortar and not even know it from the outside.
But from the inside, you would see evidence of this.
Hopefully you would see evidence. So, you know, some kind of, you know, at least... examination to see, you know, can we tell? Is the brick on the inside in good shape?
Well, I could ask, you know, Jeff and Kelly, and because they're the ones that have the access to upstairs. Yeah.
And it's in their interest. They've been there for a long time. If you know, they paint it and all of a sudden they find that the brick wall starts falling down.
Yeah. And Kelly's family.
Is the vertical sign going?
No,
the one on the corner?
We're going to touch it. They'd love to get it restored, just not in the budget. That might be another phase sort of thing.
So the Schuylkill building is a bar on the south side, and I've been inside that building. Right next to it is what I call the 1907 stable building that we did some determinations on. And there's a lot of spalling inside that building. The walls have never been painted, and there's quite
a bit. In the tip top, that corner building?
Where the bar is, on the corner.
Yeah, so there's spalling in there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And it's especially prominent in the kitchen. It's like two or the whole thing.
Okay.
And on the inside and the outside, we were told there was, like, gunfights down there in the old days, the Wild West, and there were. Because I went around and found the holes. So, that one was built before this one was built, is my understanding. And so, if there's spalling down there, even in the areas where it wasn't, wounds from weapons, I'm betting on my hands.
Okay.
And it seemed to be the worst
conversation with them, because I know it's in their best interest, and then I can certainly see them trying to act in their best interest. It's just the urgency of that, right, intervention. They want to go to more best.
Along the lines of the comments were pretty good. I didn't have that in mind when I was looking at this. It's not a lot of these buildings have a quarter inch of paint, and a lot of its oldest buildings obviously were pre-war, which probably led to the permeability, which could very easily be zero of what's there. Could be. So what is the criteria of what we do then?
Well, if you know, in a situation like this, you do the best that you can. You make the wall operate the way that it's supposed to the best that you can.
But it won't if it's encapsulated. I mean, that's
only if it's encapsulated on both sides.
Right. And so you would, like, a recommendation would be to make sure that applying a paint that has a permeability of whatever, and just knowing that you're not making it significant.
Making sure that you don't prevent the brick from drying to the inside. And you painted the outside, now you can't insulate the inside, you can't paint the inside. And also making sure...
You can't paint the inside. Insulated,
if
you can't make a barrier.
Moisture is going to find a way. I'm an energy efficiency guy. I'm all about insulation, but when it comes to brick, it's asking for so many troubles. But you know, the biggest thing is the roof. If there are problems with the brick right now, the source is probably the roof. And so it's just addressing those problems first, making sure that the brick can operate, can dry out somehow before applying yet more paint to it. Considering stripping the paint and restoring it, you could consider it. I know that.
I would, just knowing, knowing the personalities of the owner, this color, I think it's a big progress to have a new color.
The color scheme and everything is definitely an improvement. So just ensuring that what is done now does not jeopardize the material of the building. And there are lots of easy things to do to ensure that that happens. And I don't think any of them stand in the way of painting the brick.
And the last question I asked, I think it's just the way the drawing was done or the framing was done. Those windows appear the same as the block out ones. They're not. That glazing is remaining.
That is on the north facing, the long side of the building, that is real glazing.
Yes.
It's just remaining. Exactly. And that's why I just thought the other ones should feel more like glazing, and we're just going to be them probably just too dark.
So the Lucky Pawn Shop logo?
Yeah.
Is that historically their logo? Is there a tag to the Lucky Logger?
Yeah. Well, I did, looking at the Lucky Logger L.
It's the same.
It's really close to it, but they just had somebody paint it. And just, I think the person that did it borrowed it. They don't have any, their logo kind of changes from thing to thing. And they don't have it in digital format. It's just this. And so I'm
saying that's not a registered trademark?
No. And did you know that the international symbol for pawn shops is those three balls?
Yeah, what's the story behind that?
I thought it was decoration. It's not. That's just they have their own colors, so that's international. So now when you're out antiquing or whatever, you just look for those symbols.
Yeah.
Pawn shop.
I know it's one.
So, but it's not registered, but it bears a very it's a very strong resemblance when you look up the Lucky Logger. And I just don't know if just the guy who painted the sign at the time saw it, just copied it, because they have their logo and other iterations on printed material. They were thinking about changing it a little bit. I'm like, I just copy what you've got and put it just on the paint and just paint it on the building.
Kind of a little out of our purview, maybe, but often those that period when the signs were painted on the building, they tend to get large. The graphics kind of got large. I don't know if this was as big as the sign had, the sign ordinance or not.
This is a particularly bad rendering, because it was in PowerPoint and I was cutting and pasting things, so you can even see where I just kind of cut.
I see that.
I was shifting it around because they said, "Hey, I think we're open to taking the awnings off." I'm like, "Great." And then I just said it would be closer to this then. They had some surface mounted conduit, and they had four lights that just were on straight arm pieces of conduit on junction boxes with kind of like red box sized light hanging back or shining back. And so I suggest
suggested that if they're going to keep that there, that we just get some goosenecks that would shine over. And so they're going to keep the boxes right where they are, and we're just going to have some black gooseneck, maybe about a 2 foot arch and just a bell shape angled back over the on the sign. We just got back to that other John. That was perfect to scroll to the old picture or the existing picture. Right below where the awning is now is where the transoms actually start. I mean, it was just like a row of brick differences. The windows started. I thought by the time that the awning came down that we'd have more room to paint letters a little taller. We don't. It's actually the windows start like a row of brick beneath that. It's actually a skinnier spot than I thought. But we're just going to get rid of the cash to love part.
There's no interest in restoring the canopy.
Really had a deep balance. I'm short. You could hit it pretty easily. Yeah.
Any more comments or feedback?
Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you. This is an interesting project. Like a good design and an improvement. I think it's sympathetic to the environment and the buildings around it. So that's good. And based on the feedback that you receive, if you have any questions, please reach out to us. We'd be happy to follow up with any additional advice.
And Sarah, it wasn't Norman Weiss, was it?
I can't be Chris.
Okay.
I'll look it up though. I've met a window guy at Main Street Events. He's a big advocate for original wood sash windows and restoring them exactly. And it was pretty cool, but I haven't met a brick guy.
That is Google. Masonry preservation lectures.
Preservation. My takeaway is the surface prep. So I'm going to talk to the owners about what the painters are planning on doing, and let's not inject the building with water where it can be used. And so what's that going to look like? What's the type of paint? And then those are the two.
Checking inside the water.
Yeah, for the efflorescence.
designed such a way that when you exit the building, there's a step right at the threshold. So you have to be attentive to the fact that as soon as you open the door, you're stepping down, which is, of course, not good in nature. The steps are only 9 inches, the trip. It's only 9 inches deep. Today's code is 11 inches minimum. I guess people had some more feedback. The rise of the treads are fine as they stand. That's the sort of the generality of the cascading stairs. If you look in the photograph, you'll see a center handrail. You'll see two of them. The upper center handrail actually stops only about 18 inches, maybe 24 inches from the door. So you don't really have much room to even center yourself, square yourself into the door. We also believe that there was no center handrail, or if there were one, it has been replaced. It is clearly a modern upstairs handrail. So what we have done for Jan is to look at what it would take to replace those stairs. The stairs are simply unsafe. And what we did is to look toward the building code for minimum accessibility requirements. Now, typically when we think of accessibility, we think of elevators or ramps. The building does have an elevator that was put in
2007.
Okay, I'm too far. 9 years ago. It is accessed from the back of the building, the east side of the building, and has a accessible route to it. There's no question that it needs to be accessible. But within the accessibility code, there are accessibility requirements for stairs, not for people who have, say, difficulty walking, but they're not. And so we turn to that code, which is actually extremely prescriptive. The United States accessibility codes absolutely limit what you can do with a stair. You can have longer treads, but the rises have to be within 7 inches. It's a very prescriptive code. There's not a lot of room to wiggle. And so what we're showing in the upper left-hand diagram that's labeled as B floor plan, if you look at the drawing, there are gray lines that indicate the existing conditions. And then over top of that are the very dark lines, which is whatever being proposed. And let me take a step back. This is really a cost estimating exercise. I think this was less than 2 hours in our office to do this, and it was really just to help Jan and her group understand what magnitude of cost they were. So I'm not presenting a design for necessarily any kind of leverage. The feedback is always appreciated, but we're probably months and months away from actually. But to get back to the explanation. In front of the doorway, then, that's the upper, almost looks like a niche in plan. This is the doorway right in here, this area. In front of the doorway, then, we're leaving approximately 5 feet. It's just under 5 feet. Building code requires minimum 48 inches, so we want to go a little bit further. Then the stairs cascade down in a very similar fashion to the way they do today. And the stair risers, are roughly six and a few inches, or six and a shade taller, and the runs are, in fact, 11 inches. That's a prescribed run for this ratio. You'll also see three vertical bars in the drawing, and those are handrails, here, here, here. The code does require side handrails. The center handrail is optional, and again, I read the code, but it is optional. And the only reason we were showing that, again, was for cost estimating reasons. If, as the design were to develop, that center handrail were to go away, there would be a cost savings. We haven't investigated the original photograph, you know, the opening day photographs or anything like that, to assess exactly what kind of handrail was there, whether it was a single central one, or if there were no handrail at all. I think that is possibility as well. But today's code would require side handrails, there's no question. How those would be executed, whether it be simple inch and a half tube steel, which is the standard, you know, industry standard for handrails, that would be one way of doing it, to make it look modern and not try to be store size. If it were, the decision were to make it look a little more integrated with the aesthetic of the building, then it could be more store size style. Once you cascade down 9 risers in the new construction, there's a flat area, and then 3 more risers. In the existing stairs, there's something identical to that, and that's the first 3 risers and the landing are the first handrail you see, and then you get the cascading stairs that go for the second handrail. So, again, keeping it similar in character to the existing stairs. In the photograph, you see there are some side pylons, as well as the standards for the globe lamps. Those would stay. The pylons would stay. They would get a little bit buried in the new cascading stair, but they would still be there, so that feature. And as we thought about this, again, it was really for a cost exercise, because this is replacing existing historical structures, stair. Always the question is the stair a distinctive feature, or is it the windows and the terracotta work, etc. We would anticipate that as the stairs were designed, they would be clearly differentiated from the original building's aesthetic. And what I mean by that is to have gaps between the buildings, flanking pylons, so that it was clear that these were added. Modern, and of course, it could always be torn back out if necessary, and the distinctive features, which I would argue these lampposts are a distinctive feature, would be able to remain intact and not be damaged by the construction. So that's the stairs. Feedback welcome. At this point, it's so early.
Again, this was just for cost estimation purposes. So if we get the grant money and we're able to do this project, it's obviously, since this is on the local and national historic register, it's going to come back in front of the commission for comment. But figured we'd start early. So what kind of feedback would you like?
The conceptual approach, I think, is always the best at this early stage. So what I'm trying to describe is that idea of a modern, code-driven, but a modern, distinctly separated cascading stair.
So I'm a little confused by your last comment, Eric, about being able to demo it out if you wanted to go back to the original staircase, and your comment about the lamps. So the lamps would remain, right?
The lamps, what I'm calling the pylons, I can't think of the word of those things that they sit on, actually, if you look at the photograph.
Yeah.
Lamps come down on things that they sit on.
Lamps
is usually the
I'd call it a pedestal.
Pedestal for the lamps. Lamp pedestal. Yeah, so those would stay. The pedestals would stay. And see, the pedestals actually have a little bit of architecturally very small, but a little bit of architectural expression. If you look at the photograph, there's actually a line that differentiates the cap. And then in the front of the pedestal, there's that relief. It's just a simple square relief.
So would you end up burying part of that relief?
They would be buried, and that's why the design concept would be to hold the new construction back from that, so as to not deface that, so that in the future, if those stairs were to come out, they wouldn't be replaced with the original. The original are unsafe. But if for some reason those stairs were to be removed for some future restoration work or anything like that, the plinths wouldn't be.
My 2 cents on the stair is, I think that we said that all of these current contemporaries have the same stair. In all of the country, it is a monolithic stair. It's the main entry. My 2 cents would be, I wouldn't look at it as a modern
know that these were the original stairs?
It's very likely based on their the one or two photographs that I do recall seeing, and also their age. They're clearly of the same concrete cast as the plinths.
By getting rid of that initial threshold drop, that's what would lead to the burying of the...
Exactly right.
I mean, it's really hard to... You have to kind of twist your body to get into that building with that, partly because the rail is so close to the door. Mm-hmm. And they have people that trip. We're just lucky we haven't had someone break a leg.
That was my question. Have there been any incidents?
Yeah, there's been twisted ankles, and there's been people stumbling, and we've tried to, like, skim coat the stairs because they're cracking, and now the skim coating of cement's breaking off. So
you think this is necessary?
I think it's a safety issue. When you walk up those stairs, it's what Eric went over all the problems with them, the landing and the risers, and it's really a safety issue.
Eric, it looks like in form you've tried to pretty much not replicate this, but interpret it very closely.
Right.
Were you thinking of differentiating it just with color?
It would actually just be separated physically by some kind of a standoff.
A little better.
Just because of safety, it can't be much more than half an inch.
So these are going to be
railed off,
which I think would start to cobble up the look.
These are going to be a little bit wider than the original. I guess this has nothing to do with historic preservation, but my concern would be, you know, when they put Esther Short and Dolan Benson, the skateboarders have a heyday. And so you might have to go back to putting something in that center because that's, you know, 18 inches is perfect, and the skateboarding crowd. And if there was something in the middle, that would take all the fun out of it.
Never found a rail that wasn't on the ground. So more rails.
I think that one of the ways to mitigate the burying would be to look at pulling that top landing back a little bit closer to the minimum that's allowed, because that will shift those lower stairs a little bit lower and could prevent them from wrapping around in front of there as badly. I think it's, you know, there's the tension between making sure that landing is really sufficient, and maybe 48 inches is sufficient, maybe it's not. I think that the safety does come first. I do like how you've really echoed the original design aesthetic, and I think that that's actually really successful. From the pictures of Carnegie libraries that I've seen, there would have been no rail, you know, historically. So I think the side rails are probably going to be a lot more compatible. I like the idea of using the modern materials instead of some kind of, you know, kitschy faux historicism. I think that that's a great approach. And you know, overall, I think the only other thing that concerns me a little bit is it seems like you're almost creating a little pit back toward the building, because the return comes in having the stairs go down back to the building. Maybe it's an issue, maybe it's not. You can only tell so much stuff from plan.
They currently do that, but
it's like one step does it, as opposed to three. And I think the other thing about if you pull that back, so if you pull that landing at the top back a little bit, then that engages these stairs to the building a little bit higher. Maybe that's not as big of an issue.
Yeah. And there's really no reason, getting back to that point of where the dead squirrels go, that's what I just called it.
Yeah.
There's no reason that it has to cascade down on that side. Code will allow us an 18-inch drop without guardrail requirements or anything like that. So we could stop the last two at the back.
I think having at least one dog-ear step on the side, at least one, is important to maintaining that character. But the rest could just go back to the building.
Yeah.
It does seem like the side handrails further bury those pedestals.
Yeah, it's
there's not much to do.
Yeah. In fact, the handrails are going to have to be guardrail height because of the proximity to the plinths, and now we're above the plinths another 42 inches high. It's just not going to be great. But we can make it look clean, modern. Maybe people see it, not see it.
you could always go with Pacific Northwest Pomo and do the posts with a solid top and wires.
No.
That would be great juxtaposition and differentiation.
Eric, what about arching the handrails and then proceeding on the top? I mean, why do you have to go straight up to the
wood?
Is that good?
Yeah, because what I was referring to is those plants. So what's happening, as was noted earlier, is that this landing is actually higher than these plants. So technically, we now have a fall prevention. In general, would the commission say there a general consensus that recalling the cascade characters is a good approach?
I think it's essential, actually. And I think since the rise is okay, maintaining the number of steps, even if you shift where they are laterally, I think maintaining the number is important, and then just mitigating the impact of the shifts that need to be done for safety. You know, I think that the historic character of these steps, it's important not just explicitly what they look like, but also the way that they function. And I've seen people coming out of this building, because I used to work just around the corner, and if we make it, if the condition of it makes it not functional, then that's just as bad as ruining how it looks. As if, you know, if we turn these kind of grand central entrance into one that nobody uses, and everyone uses the side entrance because they're not going to fall on their face or break their hip, I think that that's important.
I think you're headed in the right direction, Karen.
So more to come. Hopefully we'll get the money, because otherwise this plan is going to sit right like it is on the shelf for a while.
Do you know what kind of salts they're using for the de-icers?
I have no idea, but I knew they do put stuff on that.
Because there are salts that will do less harm to the concrete than others.
Well, yeah, but bear in mind, we are talking about 106-year-old concrete, horizontal concrete.
Well, I'm thinking for the new concrete, yeah, and also the exposure of to the brick, and then as long as the old concrete is there, you know, not making it as bad, you know, keeping it from getting worse faster.
Okay, so if you have a suggestion on what kind of salt.
Potassium chloride.
Potassium chloride. I'll pass that on to us.
So the other thing that I included for several years, as I mentioned, there's a project that's underway that is just about to start construction. It was a project that started with removing asbestos tile flooring inside the building. The remaining asbestos tile flooring, which guaranteed is not original tile.
Yeah, which had many updates on that floor.
Oh, yeah. Which has morphed into quite a smorgasbord of maintenance kinds of things. And I wanted to, so we were just about at the end of the project, just about to go out to bid or into procurement, and it dawned on me we are actually proposing some exterior work, which is repainting, so that should be less controversial, but we're actually proposing to remove some of the wrought iron grills that are stuck on the building, who knows when, that are not original to the building, but actually are over top of the existing arch, large arch. So if you take a look at that photograph in the back, on the two flanks, the pavilion flanks of the building to the side, there are the 3/3 windows. And you can see in the photograph, mostly through the shadow lines, that there are security rails across those. Those are not original, but it's my understanding that when the building was put on the registry, those existed. I don't know the rules, but they're certainly not a defining characteristic of the building, but they were there when it was put on the
register. They're not called out in the register nomination anyway.
That's good. So it's dawned on us really late in the game. Was it you, Jan? I brought it up with, over the phone. Yeah, it was over the phone. It was one of these sort of things. And so I wanted to make sure that the commission could weigh in on this. So it is. So there are these just these two large windows on the two pavilion side facades. Those are the only ones that are big. There are grills everywhere else around the building, mostly in the lower windows, that are remaining. The vandalism and breakage occur a little too often. It makes sense to keep those just from security.
Do they resemble the grills on the front facing windows here?
They're very similar.
So why just remove the ones on the front, not the ones on the side?
Katie doesn't want it to look like a jail.
I think bank when I see those.
No. It just felt like it would be more welcoming without the bars. And part of the reason they're on there is because some of the windows don't operate correctly and you can't latch them. So they're going to repair some of the windows and they're going to take them all off and repaint the whole thing, but then they're going to put the bars back on everything except the front windows. We had a break in about 3 weeks ago. They smashed in one of the panes on the front window and opened the door and went in and got on the horse in the
best
part. Exhibits.
That's the best part.
And then apparently were, I would say, drug or alcohol and passed out and fell off the horse. And the cops got there and she hadn't stolen anything. She'd broken the window and she was passed out on the floor. So Katie said, well, if you got to have a break-in, that's probably the best. Yeah, they didn't steal anything and they caught the person. But anyway, were there cameras? No.
So is there going to be an alarm system at some point?
Well, there was an alarm system, which is how the cops got there and knew there was a break-in.
Okay.
It's not a great alarm system, but it worked well enough to keep the police there. So.
Kind of like the heat in the building. It's not a great heat system, but the system doesn't work.
We are also applying for another pot of money to do air conditioning in the building. So hopefully lucky with that one, too. That one's way more than the stairs. So
you need to proceed.
Well, just by way of information then, on the interior, which I understand is we can kind of mess with as much as we want, but what the main thrust of the floor replacement, floor replacement, originally was going to be take out the asbestos tile and put down the vinyl tile. Fortunately, we were doing a walkthrough with the director as well as the facilities folks, and there was a small piece of the existing Doug Fir underlayment that's fairly narrow board underlayment exposed. And I at that point said, well, why don't we see if we can use that floor, get that floor back. Anyone who knows Doug Fir is very soft. There's this mastic that is between now that subfloor and the tile. That tile is hot, but the mastic is not. So the way the drawings are set up right now is that asbestos tile will be removed. The mastic will remain and then be removed by a floor refinishing company. So it's not by an asbestos guy. With the intent that the base bit of the project is to bring that Doug Fir floor back to life. If it's... Honestly, I don't know what the original flooring was in there. I can guarantee it wasn't asbestos tile. Fir was used for flooring, but the fir doesn't appear to have been finished. We're only looking at certain areas that were damaged by water. That's why the tile has come up. So, bottom line is, once we get that mastic up, if the floor is refinished, we'll be able to assess whether it was original or not, and I think that will lead us to decide whether we're staining it or not.
The basement's getting high.
Yeah, the basement, which from what we know was just concrete slab, has asbestos tile on it. That's going out every time. If the mastic destroyed or removal of the mastic destroys the Doug Furr. One option is to go back with VCT, which to me is kind of the nuclear option. I think it's just awful. The other option is to go back with hardwood. Very controversial, in my opinion. But the reason hardwood makes some sense is that in the room that's called 107 Exhibit, which is the 1948 edition of the back of the building, we did a remodel of that quite a while ago, in which we gutted out the all the gypsum board on that building and exposed all of the construction of that portion of the building. The original trusses are exposed. If you ever walk into the space, you'll see it's just we even left the plaster furring, all the vertical furring.
We did a lecture.
Perfect. You've been in the space. So at the last minute, I was involved with that renovation. At the last minute, someone came through with a donation or some kind of in-kind assistance and put down what I call a gym floor, put down a wood floor. So the idea is if we do have to go back to flooring, my VCT to me is not the most desirable floor. It's functional. The wood floor would be consistent with that work that was done several years ago. So now you have a uniform wood floor throughout the museum. The floor could be removed in the future, but that's the idea. So those are the three options, and we're going to evaluate them just based on what shape the wood is in once we get the master cloth, and then what kind of budget and aesthetic choice the director. Then, as I mentioned, there's some exterior painting, but the idea is we're going to take that lead paint off, put up some new paint, and walk away, same color, no differences. There are little details that we've discovered, some of the steel lintels over the windows, and they're painted the same color as the windows, so we're going to paint, which is unusual, but we're going to come back and paint those lintels the same color as the windows. So the idea is that when you walk by it today, and you walk by it in 6 months, you wouldn't know the difference except that the iron bars are gone.
I think for the flooring, if I know that some of the buildings in downtown, they did just leave the fur exposed because they had intended to put something nicer on top of it, just never got around to it, and it was good enough. I think some investigation, if it's possible to find out what might have been there, could really help the decision. Also, maybe looking at some of the other Carnegie libraries. It's only going to reveal so much since you know all of them were a little bit different, but you know, that could also give some hints as to a good approach to go.
Yeah, I actually wrote an article on this, was published in the annual, gave a lecture. They ran out of money on this building, and it was quite funny. It was very funny. It's almost a farcical way of trying to get more money from the Carnegie. Anyway. So I wouldn't be surprised if the place that they saved the money was on interior furnishings. I wouldn't be surprised about the fur. And we'll know. Hopefully the removal of the mask paper should show if there was wear on that floor. And if there was, then that will tell us that that was the furnishing. But I've never been able to find any writing describing that opening day or anything like that. There was a controversy with the Grand Army of the Republic ladies occupying the lower floor of the building, and there's a lot of colorful history. But I've never been able to find anything that describes the actual experience on the inside of the building.
Anyway, hopefully money, and we'll be back in front of you with the next iteration of the stairs.
There's a lot of movement afoot. There's a skylight in there. A lot of movement afoot to restore that skylight. Very excited. Very, very excited. Thank you, everybody. Yeah,
because Katie wants a bigger building, and I said, hey, we're putting all this money in this building, you're not moving.
Okay.
Budget update?
Budget update, let me just click. So, Jade and I have talked a lot in the last meeting about, jumping right into plaques and interior panels. So we talked about, you all were almost making a decision on doing national
National Register plaques for the four buildings that we discussed, the farm, courthouse, Lukey, and museum.
Museum.
Is that what?
Wait, are you talking about interpretive panels?
Well, these could be all three. Plaques was the farm, the courthouse, the Lukey, and the Kings.
The National Register plaques.
And then we had a conversation about it would be really nice to be able to have more of that, why it's historic, why it's on the register, on the plaque, and how they are designed, that they're just not meant for that. So Jan and I discussed it, and we have done these interpretive panels around city, like the one at the Kiggins, there's Esther Short, Slocum House. What if we did not only the regular National Register plaque for those buildings, but also an interpretive panel at the site? And then we get both. So we'd be using the budget, some of the budget funds, to do both of those things. So we wanted to kind of propose that idea and see if you would be okay with us moving forward on something like that.
That sounds like it addresses the two concerns.
It does. The one thing about...
Well, the concern last time was that we put up a plaque and nobody really knows the history, and you can't fit it all on a plaque without spending like three times more.
Yeah. And the problem with interpretive panels is that sometimes, like after a year or two, they start looking not so great, and they don't, I mean, in some ways they, especially when they're really close to the building in question, I feel like they kind of diminish the historic feel of a building, because it's, you know, not, it's not an architectural feature in line with the building. I wish there was a way to get that classic register plaque that was actually informative as to why it's on the register.
Yeah. And I mean, just what I found was, you had like the roadside markers.
Right, right. The big dual sided.
But not the ones that you like place on the building. They all kind of had that, you know, generic text that's listed on the National Register,
on this date, which is like, Not that informative.
Technical term.
How is this panel, how do you envision it being mounted? How big would it be?
Is it the actual interpretive panel or the plaques? So we have four interpretive panels that we did, I don't know, 2 years ago. One is the Slocum House, one is Esther Short Park, one is the Witness Tree, which isn't there anymore.
And those are all a lot different than something in the downtown commercial zone.
But the Kiggins is removed from the building itself.
The street, because the sidewalk in front of the Kiggins was too narrow.
Okay.
So when you look at the panel and you lift your head and look at the Kiggins across the street.
Okay.
So
I think that's actually a really effective way to do panels for buildings, is to have them
a little farther away.
To have them on the other side of the street, because then you can also place them at the street edge where people can safely stand on the sidewalk, and they can see the whole building, as opposed to being right up against the building and kind of craning their heads to look around at little parts of it.
We have to go through our traffic people to make sure, you know, there's no sight line obstructions. And so this time, Jackie'd like to do one for the poor farm. We'd like to do one for the courthouse,
which has a lot of property.
The Clark County Historic Museum, who did all the text and photos, would like one in front of their building. And then a fourth one that would be up for discussion. Lukey is a possibility.
I think the building mounted plaques, I think that's a great way to communicate to the public that, oh, this is, you know, even if it doesn't have a lot of details, especially since there is the app, you know, that you can look and get the details. And then for the interpretive ones, to start with places where placement is easy. You know, I think that that's a good approach. See how they work. You know, do the easy ones, see how it works, see how the public responds, and then decide whether or not to go and try to do some of the harder ones in the future.
So this is the money that we have to spend by the end of the year, so we're going to do this.
I think, you know, like you said, the courthouse would be an easy place. I mean, they've got plenty of real estate, and the poor farm, you know.
I like the courthouse idea.
I think Lupke might be, you know, you put it across the street, now you're on somebody else's real estate.
Well,
and they may
the
have
church.
Yeah.
The church, which is a whole different
right,
site.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's a new Vine bus stop right there.
I mean, we have to go look at the site and
yeah.
see if one will fit there.
Yeah.
The historic museum, we should be able to find someplace on the side of the building, or, I mean, there's lawn.
Sounds like you have three real easy ones.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Lupke might be tougher, or if you have other suggestions besides Lupke, the VDA is working with the city on a new piece of public art where the Piggins plaque currently is, and it's a stylized movie camera that spins in the wind. And she was like, oh, it'd be really cool if we could have an interpretive plaque that talked about the history of all these old movie theaters, and we could put it right next to the Kagan's one. And I was like, that feels like too much.
Yeah.
Those bus stops are awesome. I don't know how C-Tran feels about having stuff on them, but the interpretive stuff doesn't always have to be right by the building. If it's,
right.
You can encourage people to go look at buildings by using up some of that real estate.
Source stuff.
So if you guys are okay, we'll move forward with doing four additional interpretive panels and the four historic plaques, and we'll try to figure out the fourth interpretive panel as we get into this and look at what the options are.
Did we? For the historical museum, they're putting in a four-story, 116-unit building.
Right.
Micro apartments, all those two bedroom condos. So that would be a good place to put an interpretive panel right across.
But it's not going to happen for a while because it's under construction. So.
Right. Yes.
Well, because
that happens. With the money.
Yeah. It's just that the the museum's like, hey, if you're going to do more of these, since we did all the research, and
always,
we bought one.
We can always move them to
It's just
Just get them paid for and built. And,
I think the museum has enough real estate to get it on the same side. It's not like the downtown.
No, it's not.
Things are tighter.
The building's right up against, Lupke's like right up against the sidewalk.
Did we decide on a plaque type? Because I know that there were some options that we were looking at last time.
Yes. Do you want to do that exercise? I mean, we could do it by email. Like I said, these are the options. I don't think there's that many. So, and you guys can kind of do a straw, vote on which.
I think that would be a good way to do it.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Well, might also come down to your budget.
It seemed like they were, it's just a kind of stylistic differences and depending on the size.
And the question, do we want them all to be consistent, I assume?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so I'll send that out.
Send the statement.
So just to update, we did the Two Rivers Heritage Museum sponsorship. So we sponsored them for their Heritage Days. So for sure we're sponsoring that event. Was that the only other one? I don't remember. That was the very beginning. Last one.
Clark County Historic Museum.
Yeah, North Clark Historical Museum. And we're still going to work forward on that essay and art contest. So we'll get back to us when they know more from the school district on when that's going to fall within their curriculum. So that's moving forward. We'll keep you updated on that. I wanted to check with Robert. Did you get any chance to talk to the Little Center Museum? Okay, cool. So if he's good with that, that's another option for us to do, is to nominate that building. And then looks just moving forward, unless anyone has anything else on the budget discussion, I'll move to the next item. Okay. The camp, which I'm really excited about, is coming. Like I forwarded that email to you all, so we were talking about that last month, so hope everyone will be able to attend that, and I think it'll be a great opportunity to get into historic preservation on the commission level and staff level, so I think that'll be a great training.
They don't have it yet.
It's just
going to,
they'll look at it more.
March.
Yeah.
Yeah, and did they decide where they were going to do that?
I think it was Tacoma.
And the one question for tonight is, are we willing to be one of the sponsors?
Right, that was in the email.
Right.
And
so they're looking for some of the bigger, communities.
Bigger municipalities.
Kick in $500 to $1,000 to sponsor the training.
I think they're not, well, I don't know. I think it's the training is free for commission members.
Yeah.
I mean, there's obviously going to be some travel.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's like a one day. So, okay. If people are all right with that.
Cool. Good. Okay. Anyone have anything else, old business or updates? Move on. Okay. Chair elections.
Yep, new business.
So I'll just open it up on the floor for any nominations. We need to start with maybe chair and then vice chair. That works. Okay.
Well, yeah. I'm comfortable with doing it another year, either in the chair or vice chair role. A lot of change this year. I think it's working fairly well. So that's my two cents.
Is there a protocol? This would be, I think, the first time I've seen chair elections. And a lot
me
of
too.
Me too.
Yeah.
I mean, if we have got in the past have protocols, usually we just have a nomination. Someone proposes a name and second, same kind of process as a normal vote would be.
I really appreciate and am excited about Robert's willingness to carry the torch for another session.
I mean, status quo is a pretty easy vote, right?
It's
I mean, if everybody, I'm happy with the chair and vice chair remaining as is for another year.
Another, next year, right?
I mean, I also feel like I have time commitment issues, so I wouldn't want to.
Yeah, unless there's someone who wants to try out one of those roles.
Sarah, do you want to do vice chair again?
Yeah, I like vice chair because I just, I also am a community development kind of person. I think everybody should get a chance if they want a chance. So it's not, I don't need to nominate as a particular job. That's all I'm saying. So.
Do we have elections again next year?
Yeah.
I mean, a year goes by very quickly. We've got two new positions. You know, I feel like.
Yeah. It's 10 months now. So.
Well, I mean, you guys have the most experience on the board. I think it kind of makes sense to
agree.
So come next year, everybody can make it step
up. I'm starting my campaign
there
now.
Put your buttons on.
Yeah, and we'll have the camp training, so that'll be a really good opportunity. So one of the things that helped me a lot was at the NAPC forum 2 years ago and being able to go through that training. And, you know, if I hadn't done that, this would have been very difficult. So that was a great opportunity. So I think anyone who is interested, take advantage of all the training opportunities that you can because they're very good, very helpful.
Okay, so
consent.
Let's do a
consensus.
Yeah.
Do we need a motion?
Yeah, we need a motion, Rob.
I move that we continue forward for the next season with Robert as chair and Sarah as vice chair.
A second motion.
Aye.
All right. Excellent. Okay. Last, I think it's the last thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the historical promotion grants deadline is in a couple weeks, on the 18th, I believe. So as we did last year, we'll need a subcommittee to review the applications that will then be brought forward to the Historic Commission for their formal recommendation that will then go to the Board of County Councilors for approval. So kind of wanted to see if I could get three of you to volunteer for that. And it's pretty much one meeting. It took us an hour and a half, maybe, to go through them. And
when would that be, that one meeting?
So probably October. So you know, we'll, whoever's the three will work on a time and a date to do that. And last year, before us, it was an ad hoc kind of committee that included various historic preservation people throughout the county. That some passed away, and then some moved away. Or but Pat Gelato was on there, and she worked with us and sat on our committee last year. So my plan is to invite her as well to be the fourth member if she's interested in.
Yeah. And how last many? Year it was Sarah and Rock,
yeah.
So some new faces want to get involved.
Shall you?
Okay. Sean?
I'm actually going to be traveling a fair amount in October, so I'm worried about making a commitment.
Sure. Rock? All right. I'll start
off. Okay.
All right. That's what we'd like to hear.
I have to go. My child has a huge project tomorrow, and she's very upset about it. New to middle school and goes on and on. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay, can I?
Well, I'm
going to
put you on a subcommittee. So.
So
anybody else? Do you have a third?
You need a third?
Yeah.
I'll do it.
Want to do it again?
Cool. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Nice
awesome.
To have somebody that did it last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might have to run that criteria scoring sheet by again.
You're
like, work this whole thing. So, yeah, we'll work on that. Okay, that's all I have. Anyone, round table, anything? Anyone wants to?
Yeah, I'd just like to bring up one takeaway from the NAPC conference in Mobile this year. And the one thing that I thought was really interesting was they talked about edgy tourism a lot and dealing with some of the darker issues that they face with historic preservation in the South, specifically slavery and some of those types of issues. And the one thing that really impressed me is that because of the region it was in, many of the attendees had those types of issues, whether it was Tennessee or Georgia or Alabama.
Edgy tourism?
Edgy tourism, that was one of the names of the, one of the seminars. And I got to thinking, you know, we do face this a little bit with some of the Indian tribe issues, and we sometimes shy away from the politics of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel that if they can address those types of issues with slavery and, you know, execution, racial terrorism, as it was, you know, we should probably have the courage to be able to step forward and address some of those issues if it comes up, and deal with that as we need to. So that was just the thought that I had, and just food for thought in the future. All right, public comment? No? Crickets? All right, so no public comment. I'll go ahead and accept a motion to adjourn, if anybody has one.
I move that we adjourn this meeting.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed?
So, Alex, are you going to set up your super bathroom?
You're going to be the campaign manager?
Absolutely.
Get a few yard signs in here. Yeah. Should I turn this off, Jackie?